Hi everyone, and welcome back to this podcast series on the life of Lucius Annaeus Seneca. This is podcast number 19, the Quinquennium Neronis. Okay, we're at the end of AD 55, and Nero's been on the throne for just over 1 year. His stepbrother Britannicus, a potential rival for the throne, is dead, most likely murdered. And his mother, Agrippina, whose ambition to be the power behind the throne and to rule through her son, has been put back in her box and made to move out of the palace proper after some clever behind-the-scenes manipulation by Seneca. Seneca, Nero's one-time tutor and now the amicus principis, that's the emperor's closest advisor, along with Burrus, the commander of the Praetorian Guard, were, to all intents and purposes, running the empire, and, by all accounts, doing a pretty good job of it, as they are reported as handling political and domestic affairs in an even-handed and fair manner. Although, to be fair, after the reign of the nutter Caligula, and the curbs put on the patrician classes towards the end of Claudius's principate, even-handed and fair probably meant anything that didn't involve either arbitrary execution or diluting the prestige and privilege of the higher echelons of Roman society. Now, it's always struck me personally as quite odd that many historians have often referred to the first 5 years of Nero's rule, the so-called Quinquennium Neronis, a phrase first coined by the later Emperor Trajan, although what he meant by it is often disputed, as some kind of golden bubble in an otherwise tumultuous period. The general idea behind this golden era idea is that influential adherents of the Stoic philosophical school, that's people like our Seneca, were consciously orchestrating Roman politics in a kind of masterclass status quo, in which, by avoiding any kind of reformist program, they were preventing Nero from tyrannizing his subjects. It was supposedly a little haven in time, a period free from corruption, abuse, and crime. The problem is that when you read between the lines of the available evidence, it becomes readily apparent that everything started to go pear-shaped very early on, and that Nero had started to run riot pretty much right from the beginning of his reign. Now, I've stated over and again during this podcast series that the ancient commentators who reported on this period in history were, for the most part, writing after the event, under different dynastic imperial houses, and with their own political agenda. So not everything, in fact not a hell of a lot, can be taken at face value. On the other hand, when the different accounts are in broad agreement about general trends, then it would be foolish to dismiss them out of hand. Now, one such trend is the almost overwhelming consensus that Nero started to go off the rails almost as soon as he descended the throne, and that Seneca and Burrus were running scared and in fear of their own lives as early on as the murder of Britannicus in early AD 55. Cassius Dio, writing a few generations after the events, reckons that Seneca and Burrus were so spooked by Nero's worsening behaviour that they stopped actively trying to improve the running of the empire, the implication being that far from conducting a Stoic political masterclass by maintaining the status quo, something that makes it sound as if Seneca and Burrus were in some kind of overall control of the situation and working to some kind of cunning plan, that in reality the pair were desperately trying not to provoke Nero's envy. Their only recourse then would have been to scramble to keep the ship of state on an even keel and as free from scandal and excess as they could. Now, that wasn't a Stoic masterclass. It was instead an ongoing reactionary campaign. A moment-by-moment reaction was something no card-carrying Stoic would want to be seen dead doing. The whole thing was a constant battle to head Nero off at the pass of his knee-jerk whim. It was a cop-out tactic, a failure on the part of Seneca and Burrus to set boundaries and impose behavioural guidelines at the most formative period of the young emperor's reign. Put simply, Nero had psyched them out. All Seneca and Burrus' softly-softly approach achieved was to encourage Nero to more and more outrageous shenanigans. So with his two closest advisers no longer daring to try to mould the young man into their ideal of a philosopher king, or perhaps realising it was a futile exercise and waste of energy, Nero was arriving at the realisation that he wielded absolute power, and he began to test its boundaries. Now, it's well documented that the teenage emperor had a flair for the dramatic. And what I'm about to describe will give you some idea of just how much the young Nero was beginning to understand he could get away with. The ancient sources, some more sensationally than others, describe how the emperor would sneak out of the palace at any time of day or night, disguised as a normal Roman citizen. Apparently he kept a variety of wigs and costumes for the purpose, and he'd haunt the city's bars and brothels. He's accused of all sorts of disgraceful behaviour, raping women, sexually assaulting boys, and stripping the clothes from those he encountered, and then beating or wounding them. The lucky, it's said, were left naked, robbed, and bleeding on the ground. The unlucky were murdered. Well, Nero may have taken pains to disguise himself, but it was patently obvious to everyone who it was that was trolling the city with violent and predatory intent. Not only were the bodyguards he took along for the ride easily recognised, but the fact that an individual could be allowed to so openly and repeatedly violate the city's laws with apparent impunity also served to give the game away. Now, Nero was impetuous and reckless, but he wasn't stupid. So it seems to me that he knew full well everybody could see through his disguise, and that the citizens were fully aware that the monster haunting the nighttime Roman streets was none other than the emperor himself. And yet he carried on doing it, which says to me that Nero must have actively delighted in the atmosphere of terror he was creating. Now that is not the behaviour of a sane mind. And Nero was only just starting to understand just how much power he wielded. The people began to sense that with such a deviant personality in command, there would be a lot more that they themselves could get away with without being hauled in front of the magistrates. The elder Pliny, a contemporary of the events described, says that gangs of thugs and thieves began to emulate Nero's behaviour. They dressed up in wigs and clothes similar to Nero's disguises and started assaulting and robbing the members of the patrician class they encountered in the city's streets, and they were secure in the knowledge that nobody would dare arrest them just in case they turned out to be the emperor. Nighttime Rome, writes Pliny, became totally lawless. Nero only started to pull his head in, and then only slightly, when a senator, one Julius Montanus, incensed by an outrage committed on his wife, beat the disguised Nero black and blue. And just as an aside, when Nero had been on the receiving end of a bashing during his nocturnal adventures, he tried to cover up the bruises with a paste made from Thapsia sauce, frankincense and wax, a cosmetic mask that hid the damage and gave him a kind of unblemished appearance. Julius Montanus, though, had obviously recognised he was lavishing a pasting on the emperor, and then, though, he made the mistake of sending a note of apology. Now, to Nero's mind, that wasn't playing the game to his own rules. He obviously saw the whole thing as a bit of a lark, totally disassociated from his official persona. So he openly made it known that the senator had knowingly struck the emperor, and Montanus, as a consequence, was forced to commit suicide. After that incident, though, Nero continued with his nighttime excursions, but now he'd stand back and let the soldiers he'd brought along with him do the dirty work while he looked on in approval. And by all accounts, the budding social anarchy delighted Nero. He encouraged the unrest to spread to the theatres and the races, two venues he loved with a passion, so that the praetors' and consuls' attempts at maintaining order were totally ignored, and punch-ups and general chaos became the order of the day. It's reported that Nero, unseen by the crowd, loved to watch the disorder unfold. He's even said to have forbidden the armed praetorians responsible for enforcing law and order at those public events from attending them, just so that he could watch on in glee as the violence was allowed full rein. And Nero's blossoming psychopathic excesses weren't limited to just the chariot races in the theatre. In the games arena, he elevated the term wholesale slaughter to whole new heights. In one Nero-sanctioned spectacle alone, the emperor's bodyguard massacred 400 bears and 300 lions, while 300 members of the equites, or the knightly order, the next in rank below the patrician class, were allowed to fight as gladiators. And speaking of the equites, the knightly order, in another attempt to get up the noses of the patricians, something the emperor obviously delighted in, and incidentally spice up events by introducing an extra layer of danger, Nero had the channels originally made by Julius Caesar to protect the audience from wild beasts removed so that the knightly class could have dedicated seating roles. And if there were any remaining doubt that the teenage emperor saw himself and nobody else as top dog, he had a team of hermaphrodite mares harnessed to his personal chariot, as, in his mind, it was only fitting and a splendid spectacle that the ruler of the world, as he took to calling himself, be pulled around in a miraculous chariot. Seneca and Burrus couldn't possibly have been blind to these carryings-on, but they were obviously powerless to stop them. The year AD 56, in fact, should have been a champagne year for Seneca. In the middle of that year, he was appointed suffect consul, meaning that he'd finally reached the pinnacle of the cursus honorum, the official Roman ladder of political office. Seneca had been quaestor sometime after AD 37. He'd been awarded the office of praetor upon his return from exile to become Nero's tutor back in AD 49, and now, 7 years on from that, he'd reached the top. The appointment would need to have been voted for by the Senate, but the nomination could only have been approved by Nero. Admittedly, the standing accrued by acquiring any kind of consulship had been diluted by the onset of the Principate, as ultimate political power now lay in the hands of an emperor, but it remained nevertheless a highly prestigious appointment. So why is it then that I feel Seneca knew, even back in AD 56, that he was in trouble, or at least beginning to realise that he was skating out onto very thin ice? Well, there are a few reasons. The certainty, and it is a certainty because it's beyond reasonable doubt, that Nero was proven a far bigger handful than Seneca could ever have imagined, was probably foremost among them. But there's also Seneca's writing. Because as we've seen so often before, whenever he felt the political pot being stirred, Lucius Annaeus Seneca's first reaction was to reach for his stylus. I've spoken before at several points during this podcast series about Seneca's writing habits and about the controversy that surrounds their compositional chronology. Some of Seneca's surviving works are truly undateable, and a few others refer to historical events, such as the recent death of the Emperor Claudius and the apocolic Entosis, or the accession of Nero and De Clementia, which allow us to place them within a very short compositional window of a year or so. But there's another category in which, although certain works are ostensibly undateable, they nevertheless contain little nuggets of information that, when matched with the correct outside reference from other sources, allows us to put on them a tentative date. Now, one such work is Seneca's De Brevitate Vitae, or On the Shortness of Life. Within the context of the whole Senecan corpus, it's quite a strange book in that it starts off as if it'll become yet another pretty average and standard text promoting the Stoic philosophical system. But then it veers off and it becomes very personal with reference to its addressee, somebody called Paulinus, but personal in such a way that I myself, flying in the face of much academic opinion, believe that it bears direct relevance to the events of AD 55 and AD 56, and that in it can be found some of Seneca's rising tone of anxiety about his increasingly tenuous moral hold on his one-time charge, the Emperor Nero. It's also, in my opinion, a superb example of Seneca using literature as a revenge vehicle against those whom, to use a modern street gangster term, were disrespecting his status. And I'll explain all about that in my next podcast, and I hope to see you there.